Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 702, a very special episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Not like must-see TV, very special episode where some morality lesson is taught through a tragedy that happens to an otherwise fun-loving group of people that teaches us about stranger danger. No, not that type of very special episode. This is the first of our two San Diego Comic-Con episodes with Peter Capaldi and Sir Ben Kingsley. As I said, this episode is Peter Capaldi, who, you know, Doctor Who is coming back in the fall, and it's back in September, and just being able to, well, you know, I'll tell you what, rather than take up all the time in the intro so I can just get you to the podcast, we'll cover this in a hostful next week. We'll do our sort of Comic-Con wrap-up next week. Matt's in Finland right now, and Jonah's running around doing stuff, so we'll do that when we're all back together next week. And also Sir Ben Kingsley, who was unbelievable, and this turned out to be such a wonderfully philosophical episode from an incredibly thoughtful and wise and talented man. Ben Kingsley, like both of them, Capaldi and Kingsley, you will just want to follow them around all day and just poke them and ask them questions about stuff, because they were both fantastic. Sir Ben is promoting Selfless, which is in theaters now, which also stars Ryan Reynolds, who was also rad if you saw the Deadpool trailer, which destroyed. We'll talk about that next week. And listen to this episode of the Nerdist Podcast right now. There's a comment section at the end, and I think it came together really nicely. I was so happy with the way both episodes of the podcast turned out. The fans were great, and the guests were phenomenal, and it was, the shows were super fun. So we realized this was our fifth year of doing podcasts at San Diego Comic-Con, so hopefully we will continue to do them. Thank you for being part of the tradition, and here's the Nerdist Podcast number 702 with Sir Ben Kingsley and Peter Capaldi.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
It turns out it's not that easy to get here from Hall H on the Saturday of Comic-Con. You'd think it would just be a quick, it's just right over there. But no. So welcome. Thank you for your patience. I literally just ran off stage on the Fox panel, and we had every superhero. It was all, oh, yeah, that's how I like it.
That's fair.
Back there, when I come on stage, their mics go just a little bit
what
down.
What was the big announcement?
Well, first of all, they showed a bunch of everything. We saw footage from Victor Frankenstein. We saw footage from the Maze Runner.
I heard the Deadpool shit looked good.
Deadpool, the audience loved Deadpool so much, they jumped to their feet and demanded to see it again. And even though they were like, we're running long on time, I was like, well, fuck it, I have a microphone, play it again. It looked so good. People went bananas, and the X-Men Apocalypse looks incredible. And so it's just like all of this huge panel of X-Men. And so at the very end, which I just posted on the way over here, I took a picture of Wolverine, Fantastic Four, X-Men Apocalypse, and Deadpool all came out. And Channing Tatum was there as Gambit, and then Stan Lee. So I got all of them in one picture. So that was pretty epic.
All right. It looks like we're ready to go, Chris.
I am so... thank you for letting me come out late. I'm not trying to be
It's okay. We were really running out of steam.
What?
We didn't go into a...
Listen to Matt and Jonah and their new podcast, Running Out of Steam. I am so honored that this man has agreed to do our podcast. He is raising the bar for us. Would you please help me welcome to the stage, Sir Ben Kingsley! Thank you. I mean, let's have you sit here, I guess. Oh my gosh. My first question is, how did we get you?
I was invited.
How many Comic-Cons have you been to?
I think this is number two.
This is your second Comic-Con. What was the one you were here for first?
I can't remember.
Okay. What was it?
Last year, Box Trolls.
Yes, it was.
Oh, for
Box Trolls. Oh, fantastic.
Why'd you have your publicist sit in the back?
It is Comic-Con. I figured someone in the audience would probably know that information.
I think probably why I didn't immediately remember is that in Box Trolls, I'm not physically in the film. It's
right.
just my voice.
Yeah.
So, would you like to hear my Box Trolls voice?
Yes, please.
Does that make you feel a bit frightened?
What was your very first acting job? What was the very first thing that you ever did?
Golly, I might have been at school.
Yeah,
it was an American play called
Tennessee Williams.
Now see if I get another year on the author of the play. Thornton Wilder.
Yes.
And the play was called Our Town.
Of course.
And I played Cy Crowell, the newspaper boy.
And as the newspaper boy, you said, I think this is it. I think this is the profession.
I think I felt that sort of, you know, tingle of power.
Yeah.
As I threw the newspaper across the stage. Yeah.
Is there any of that? I mean, do you really, when you're doing theater, and obviously here, there's 1,200 people here. And there is an addictive quality to it. There's nothing... I mean, you can do... You know, of course, you've done some of the greatest films in the history of cinema, but there must be nothing like a live theater experience.
Honestly, if I think of theater... If I were a painter, I would describe theater as landscape painting.
Yeah.
And now I'm a cinema actor. It's portrait painting. I just concentrate and focus on the portrait of that individual, and I really love it. I haven't been on stage for 18 years now.
Oh, wow.
And before that, there was about an 18-year gap. I very, very rarely do theatre now. It was a good play. It was Waiting for Godot, as you say, by Samuel Beckett.
Waiting for Godot.
Yep, that's the one. That's the one. Keep coming in with those, please.
Waiting for Godot, Our Town.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
That's all I got. Just those two.
I mean, it's, what part of England did you grow up in?
North of England, Yorkshire, and then
tremendous pudding up there.
And then, keep throwing it.
Tremendous.
Thank you. And then I moved to across the range of hills called the Pennines, and I moved to Lancashire. Went to Manchester Grammar School. Nothing.
That was it.
Not one old Mancunian in the audience.
I'm surprised. Last year it was all that was here, and then this year I guess they feel like they saw it, so they didn't show up this time. But I mean, at what time did it occur to you that this is something that you could do? This is something that you could do as a profession, or did it ever?
Could do, I'm not so sure. But I was compelled to... No, I haven't finished yet. I was compelled to become an actor when I was very, very young, maybe 6 or 7. And I went to the local cinema, and I saw a most beautiful film called Never Take No for an Answer. It was about a little Italian boy, and all he had in the world, he was an orphan, all he was left with was his donkey, and he was the like the village taxi, the village haulage company. Him and his donkey were adored by the village, the Italian village. The donkey became very sick, and it's all the little boy had. And the little boy, in order to save the donkey's life, get him healed by St. Francis, needed permission to demolish the wall of the chapel to get the donkey in to be blessed. And priest, after Monsignor, after Cardinal, refused to knock the wall down. So he breaks into the Vatican, gets to the Pope, and all you see is the wonderful hand going bang on the papal seal, handing the boy it's really intensely moving, handing the boy the letter of approval. And the last scene in the film is the little boy who looked exactly like me as a seven-year-old. We could have been twins. Leading the donkey into the chapel with the shafts of light coming in through the window and the music, and I was in floods of tears. And I looked so like the little boy in the film that the theatre manager thought I was the little boy, lifted me up above the audience and said, "It's little Pepito! It's little Pepito!" And I thought, I could get used to this.
And that's when you stole the identity of the real Ben Kingsley.
That's right. That's
so it was right. just your average religious donkey heist movie.
That's right.
Have you gone back to watch it?
You know, I told this story to one of my heroes, Martin Scorsese, when we were working on Hugo. Yeah. And he and I exchanged early memories of cinema. And he himself remembers seeing the same film, and in my trailer, the next day, on my trailer worktop, was a copy of the film.
Oh, wow.
So I can watch the DVD now. And I had the same feelings when I watched it as a seven-year-old, and I had the same feelings watching it again. Very moving, very sweet film.
What happened to that actor who played Pepito?
I don't know. I don't think he grew up to... I stole his identity. Nothing happened to him. It's a ruthless business.
It is, you know. You just gotta get to the top, baby. But Comic-Con is all about fandom, and I think you probably get a sense of that when you're here. Mm-hmm. And so are there people that still, you know, make you nervous to meet or fan out to meet? Because everyone, no matter what level, being backstage at Hall H, no matter how famous or successful people are, you still see them go, "Oh my God, that's so-and-so. Oh my God, that's so-and-so." I mean, do you still get those moments?
I was working opposite, as close to me as you are now, Anthony Hopkins. And I nearly stopped breathing. We had this fantastic scene together in a film called Autobahn, which will come out soon. And there I was, opposite Tony. He was acting with me. I can't breathe. There's no air going in and out, and I can't breathe. I've got to say something soon, so I better say something quickly. So I said it, came out like that. Tony Hopkins.
It's not a bad Tony Hopkins right there.
He might have been feeling the same thing about you, though.
Maybe. It was a little bit like, you know, like doing that across the table.
You guys had a night off? Sorry? You're both knights, aren't you? You're both sirs.
Yes. Yes.
Do you guys like talk about that? Is there like a meeting where you guys get together around a table? Maybe
the
like
round
a,
table?
Like a round table?
Yeah.
Oh my God!
He's putting up the castle walls.
I've been trying to.
We're gonna have to storm it.
Yeah. I told you the plan wasn't gonna work.
Oh.
So Ben Kingsley does not appreciate the presence of your company.
Way to blow it for me, Matt.
Sorry, Jonah. We'll just hang out.
Guess it's back to the pub to figure out another plan.
I mean, all that stuff, all the accolades. I mean, it's such a strange. It must be such a strange layer to everything, right? Because you want to be an actor. You want to be an actor, and then people pile all these, you know, wonderful honors upon you for, as a reward for your work. And does it screw with your head at all?
I'm completely detached from that side of the career. I am so privileged to be a storyteller. I honestly believe that storytelling is healing. I honestly believe that it's absolutely central to our survival as human beings. And I'm deeply privileged to be a storyteller. The rest makes it simpler sometimes to get my stories across. Helps me reach an audience in a way that's huge and uncluttered and beautiful. I remember many instances where strangers have approached me. The first one was very clear, but I won't particularly go into that story. But a similar story happened when I was in a big shopping mall in L.A. And an Iranian family, this is after the House of Sand and Fog, and an Iranian family came towards me, and the girl, almost with tears in her eyes, said, "How did you know about our uncle?"
Oh, wow.
Which is beautiful. If you can reach out, I think that acting at its finest and storytelling is at its finest is when you have an opportunity to reach out to somebody and say, I know. It's very comforting.
So how do you?
And of course, I love all the rest. I love show business. I love song and dance. I love craziness. But at the center of it, I think, is something really special.
And how do you get to that without being aware of what you're doing? When you know that there's this bigger idea in your head of, you know, I want to reach out and talk to people and share stories with them. How do you get that out of the way and just do the job?
I think when you face to face with your colleagues, with your actors. And they're totally enthused by the story. When you are aware of the responsibility of a storyteller and in the hands of a great director with a wonderful script, you are locked into that moment, and it's the most extraordinary, private, sublime moment ever. Between action and cut, they are extraordinary moments. And all the rest recedes.
And then when you are portraying people who exist or have existed in the world, how much more preparation is there? Or do you prefer that to actually just sort of building a character from the ground? I mean, it's a tremendous amount of responsibility, particularly with some of the roles that you've had.
Yeah. I try and bring a genuine pattern of human behavior to everybody I play, so that whether he... I haven't played a she yet, but fingers crossed. Whether he is from history or fiction, I have to make him credible. And I mean, the guy I played who reminded this lovely girl of her Iranian uncle was a piece of fiction, but he was such a pure example of his group that he could have, you know, he felt very real to me.
Yeah.
So the historical responsibility is there when there are... In fact, recently I did portray a man who came onto the film set. And he was an extraordinary man. And I was playing him as he was being liberated from Mauthausen concentration camp. The man's name is Simon Wiesenthal. He was the greatest Nazi hunter in the world. And I met Simon in Vienna. We had lunch together in Vienna. And then later on we were filming in Budapest, and we'd recreated Mauthausen concentration camp. And it was liberated by the Americans, God bless them. And Major Harcourt's jeeps came tearing into this compound. And I, as Simon Wiesenthal, was almost dead and had in my hands fragments of evidence of the atrocities, because he drew everything on scraps of paper. And I got to the center of the courtyard and collapsed. As an actor, I was supposed to collapse dead. And then after this, we finished the sequence, the director shouted, "Cut." And I stood up from the dust and looked across, and there was Simon wiping tears from his face and smiling at me at the same time. Extraordinary moment.
Wow.
So to convey him was a great privilege, because every time that I have the privilege, and I'm not saying this lightly, and I know that the audience will forgive me and understand, every time I've had the privilege of wearing a yellow star in a film, it, for me, is a blow against those who say it never happened, and is a blow against people forgetting, and it is something that must never be forgotten, may never be forgiven, and may never be understood.
How do you personally know when you're getting it right? I'm always puzzled. Like, acting to me is such a foreign language, because it seems like you can do a version of, oh, I think I'm acting right now, but maybe I'm not supposed to feel like I'm doing anything. Or so what aligns in you that makes you feel like this is what I'm supposed to be doing?
Gosh, that's a very good question. I think it's a total letting go. It's an odd balance between doing precisely what you need to do to tell the story, and then letting go of. Oh, it's a very difficult question to answer.
Sure. No,
it's a tightrope. It's letting go of the ego, if you like, which for an actor is extremely difficult
sure.
to do. And then being at one with your fellow actor and with the moment. When I watch movies that I've been in, maybe for in a 90-minute movie, maybe there are 45 seconds of me where I say, ah, now you've let go.
Really?
Oh, tiny, tiny fragments.
So are there films which people watch and they consider like, oh, well, this is one of the great pieces of cinema, and they see your performance like, oh, you were so, and in your head you're going, nah, I don't think I nailed it. Is that happening? Are you away, afterwards? Do you?
Well, I certainly have been to. I've visited friends backstage when they've been in a play.
Yeah.
My most recent visit to the theatre, by the way, was to see Elephant Man with Bradley Cooper and Patricia Clarkson. They were extraordinary. But I have been backstage and. My son, yeah, Ferdinand, he's a great actor. And I went backstage to congratulate him on Man and Superman, which starred Ralph Fiennes in the West End of London. And I said, oh, Ferdy, you're crushing his ribs and hugging him and thanking him. He said, oh, I don't know, it wasn't that great tonight, Dad. And I thought, well, nobody knows. You know, nobody, only you are measuring yourself, and even you don't know. Even the actor himself or herself doesn't really know. It's a very odd process. It's a very odd dance.
Yeah, because I feel like part of what makes you a performer is a bit of an ego. Like,
of course.
Of course it's a bit of an ego. There's a draw to it, you know? It's a strange thing to do what performers do. And that's the same struggle that you have to figure out how to get that out of the way to do the thing where people don't see the ego part.
I think, you know, to simplify it, although it's a phrase that's very hard to understand and translate into action, it's just being present. And I'm still learning what that means, because it's a hard one to pinpoint, but to be alert and present.
Even in life, too.
Oh, acting is a great lesson for life.
Yeah.
It's good practice for life.
One of my favorite movies of all time is Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Wow.
Which is
one of
such
mine, too.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That movie.
Really love it.
Is such a. I was a chess player in school. In grade school, I was a chess player. I played tournament chess. And it's like they're. Especially like the other kid that he faces up against at the end.
Yes.
I played douchey little kids like that all the time.
Yes.
And I so. This one moment of the movie just reverberates in my head where Josh says to the kid, you've lost, you just don't know it yet. Like that,
yes,
to me.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's like I always wanted to have.
Yes. And he says it with great compassion.
With compassion. He doesn't want to beat him. He wants to offer him a draw.
Yeah, that's right.
And the kid's a dick and he won't take the draw. Yeah. So he's like, I'm gonna fucking trash you then. Yeah. And he does it. Pardon my horrible language, Sir Ben Kingsley. That movie, that's such a wonderful story. And so, you know, so how do you come into a movie like that? And because obviously it's about this child, you know, and you're trying to guide him through and you're trying to support him. So where do you fit in when you're not the, you know, the focal point of the story? How do you come in and support something like that?
You have to have a narrative function. You're absolutely right. To enhance the story of the hero or heroine who is at the center of the story. So that my narrative function, let's say it's a beautiful myth about a little boy with a magic sword instead of a chessboard, and he has to defeat invisible enemies with the magic sword, but he doesn't quite know how to hold it. So I would be, in that story, the dad would be the king, the mum would be the queen, and I would be the wizard. And I would be the wizard who teaches him how to see through the maze and see through clearly. It's like when I knock the chess pieces off the chessboard and say, look deep, Josh. But also, because I like to have a fragment of information in my back pocket as an actor so I can always refer to it, and it focuses me and centers me. And when I saw the film in its completion, I realized that my favorite moment in the film is not one of my moments. I'm not even on the screen. But it did become the driving force behind the film. And it's when Joe Montana says to the teacher in the classroom, and I always choke up when I hear him say it, "My son will be better at this than you will ever be at anything in your entire life." And I think, there's a dad.
Yeah.
There's a dad.
And you're connecting with that as a father.
I'm connecting with that as a son who never had a father like that.
Yeah. Mm.
As a son who never heard his father speak with pride about me, ever.
Really?
Yeah.
And so...
So I realized that there was a vacuum in me that needed to be filled. And sometimes I think that as well as hopefully helping my audience to comprehend life, I'm also filling in some empty spaces so that when I hear that line spoken by a great father, I then think, well, the great patriarchal figures that I've played, Simon Wiesenthal, Isaac Stern, Otto Frank, Mahatma Gandhi, these are all dads, in a way. Searching for Bobby Fischer, Bruce Pendlefinger, he was a father figure. So in a sense, I've invented a dad inside me that fathers me and then also presents a dad to the audience. It's the kind of ideal father that I would have wished for, but he never quite got there.
Yeah, and when my dad had the same experience with his dad. My grandfather was kind of a jerk to my dad, but he, rather than re-expressing that, went the opposite direction and made sure that I knew I was loved all the time.
Well, that's what I do, yes.
And so, you know, was that a conscious decision in your life where when I have a son someday, I'm going to make sure that this is not repeat again?
I think you have to break. There are family demons, family patterns that can be handed down like a disease from generation to generation, and sometimes it's extremely hard to break old patterns.
Because you don't know they're happening.
No, you don't. They creep up on you.
Yeah.
but yes, I am a dad, and my children know that they're loved by me.
Well, then you made it right. You were able to make it right.
So far, so good.
And when you look back at... it's interesting to hear you say that there was this, you know, sort of unseen connection point for all these roles that you're taking that you probably maybe weren't even consciously aware of until...
I didn't think I was, you're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So around when did you start to realize, oh, okay, there seems to be a pattern here?
I think having conversations like this revealed to me a pattern. Because I don't really look back. I'm not very reflective, but when I have a chance to
take down the wall.
Oh, yeah.
When I
we're back in, Matt.
The plan worked.
When I have a chance to reflect in company and publicly, I do see patterns, but I'm not normally very reflective.
Yeah. You're here, the movie you're promoting here is Selfless.
Yes,
which Ryan Reynolds is also in.
Right.
Who I just saw on the Deadpool panel. And so, yes, of course, please. So what was it about this movie that made you want to do it?
Do you hope to be rich enough one day to buy a younger body?
Because you know that's what we all hope for. You know that's what we all hope for. Is like people are constantly borrowing against future happiness, and you make unhealthy decisions when you're young. So you're like, fuck that older guy. Let him deal with it. And you just keep hoping. You cross your fingers. We're like, come on, science! Come on, science! There's going to be a pill!
Well, every year I'm on the Comic-Con floor, the 3D printing gets better and better.
So how much responsibility do you think you have? Philosophically, how much responsibility do you think we have with science? Do you think this is something that we should be toying with? If we can conceive it, why shouldn't we consume it? Or do you feel like, you know what, maybe everyone has their time and that's it?
I think the latter. I think that all the great expressions that have come out of us as humans, monumental expressions and smaller, more intimate expressions, love and the building of the pyramids are related. Love and the Taj Mahal are related. These extraordinary expressions, but they are expressions of mortality. And I think it's quite beautiful how we race against time to try and complete our journey. And I'm wondering if some magic wand, you know, told me, well, there actually isn't an end to the journey. I think a lot of my drive would go.
Sure.
It would disappear, because I think there's something beautiful about and it's an odd thing to say, but I think there's something beautiful about mortality. However, Tar Sem Singh and his film Selfless. Tar Sem Singh is obviously of Indian origin, and a lot of the Indian philosophy is related to reincarnation. And he has made a film as a director of Indian origin about reincarnation. And I found that fascinating, and that's really what drew me to the project. That, in fact, in the film, I think Ryan will agree, that the gift of immortality poses terrible challenges and problems. And you yearn for that mortality, I think.
Do you feel like... Are there many more stories that are swirling around in your head that you want? Are there things that you haven't done yet? You're like, oh, I've done this and this and this, but there's that still.
Well, I have a huge respect for the military, and I've never portrayed a man in uniform who has to take enormous decisions. And I'm hoping that I'm developing that. I'm hoping I'll have an opportunity to do that. I also love being surprised. I was completely surprised by Sexy Beast when I read the script.
Right, of course,
completely. And I opened the first couple of pages, and I realized, there he is. There's the guy. That's exactly what I need to do right now. I love being surprised. Also love working with first-time directors. Jonathan Glazer, his first feature. House of Sand and Fog, Vadim Perelman, his first feature. Extraordinary.
Why do you like working with first-time directors?
Because it's very exciting being with someone taking their first steps, who don't know the rules and therefore don't know the limits. And,
very paternal.
Very paternal.
Very paternal. Is there anything you can tell us about the thing that you did with Anthony Hopkins? Are you allowed to say anything about that? You said that was coming out soon.
Yeah. Again, if I can turn it into a sort of fairy story myth.
Please. I think you're in the right place for that, actually.
Right crowd.
Are there dragons?
In a sense, yes.
Okay, good.
There is. It all takes place in and around automobiles on the German freeway, the Autobahn. The young hero is in love with a girl who's dying, and he has broken free of crime. So the young hero, in order to save the girl's life, has to go back into hell and then reemerge from hell to save her life. And there are two demons in hell, one played by Anthony Hopkins, one played by me. Tony's more the bringer of darkness, and I am the bringer of light. I am a gangster. I'm a Turkish gangster. I'm a drug addict. I keep a brothel. I keep whores and racehorses.
But you're totally against studding out the racehorses for some weird reason. We can't do that.
It sounds a little bit like Persephone, like the tale of Persephone, of like very, going back into the underworld.
I love scripts that have an echo of the very original old stories in them. I love them.
Yeah. And then finally, do you have some... In our social media rich age, where we are constantly communicating with one another, we are constantly telling each other how we feel about things, even when we didn't ask... Do you have advice for people? Do you have some wisdom about just dealing with negativity, like dealing with negative influences, and you know when people say things? I mean, are you good with that stuff now? Do you have a place where you go? You're like, yeah, it doesn't fucking matter. Or are you able? You know, is it something that you overcame? Do you have some wisdom for that for everyone?
I don't have any wisdom. I have a theory that there is no light without shadow. Light and shade, and they do come. The universe loves symmetry, and if you have a dark moment, I can guarantee you'll have a light moment. If you can somehow acknowledge the dark moment and understand that it's part of a pattern, I can absolutely assure you that the light moment will come. Enjoy the light moment, because I am afraid I have also tell you that the shadow will come as well. It's alternating. It's a great writer described it as a black and silver thread woven together and pulled taut. And it for me, that is very much how I see life. Sometimes it doesn't help me cope with it, but I can sometimes pull back and see the bigger picture. It is light and shade, light and shade. So I personally don't think that getting out of negativity is helped by thinking positively. You have to, because that seems to be, you're in denial of the fact that it's negative. I think if you accept that it's negative, you stand much more chance of the light coming in.
Can I just follow you around and ask you questions all day?
That would be $500, please.
Yes. Well, Mr. Ben King, Sir Ben Kingsley, was gracious enough to give us a half hour of his time, but he still has another place that he has to be on this whirlwind tour. But I am so moved and honored that we were able to share this with these people. Because we do more of these, we don't do a lot of these in front of live audiences. So yeah, this was a very special moment. Can I please have a huge hand for Mr. Sir Ben Kingsley?
Thank you. Wonderful audience.
May we take a picture with you?
Okay.
Yeah. You guys wanna? Thank you so much. Yeah, it's the party going? What are you saying?
So welcome back to the Matt and Jonah Show.
Boston
time traveling Boston Batman has been through a lot.
Oh boy.
I can't tell you how stupid I felt when he was being like all wisdomful, and I was like, man, we just did 10 minutes on a Boston time traveling Batman.
Feel real dumb.
And this guy has life lessons.
Yeah. Yeah, he really iced you out with that water bridge.
It was so funny. That was funny to me. That was fine. I'll sit back and watch you. You're awesome.
No, I'm not saying it was, but you seem pretty defensive. You're like, it's fine. I don't care. I didn't give a shit. Whatever.
I didn't worry about it at all. I didn't think anything of it. I'm not going to kill myself later.
Yeah. Hey, did Chris literally just go and follow around to ask some questions? I thought he was joking.
I think that's sort of the move now. Chris now has to... He's actually at a different panel.
Yeah.
He went back
Chris
to
Harvick,
Hall
ladies
H.
and gentlemen. Guys, I just hosted another panel. It was amazing.
Oh, my God. Who was there this time?
No, so we have this guest book. We have our guest book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Chewy, yeah, we have the Chewbooka, we call it. And it was Jennifer Morrison's idea, Jennifer Morrison, for Once Upon a Time, when she came on, I had been sent this book, and I said, I don't know what to do with it. And she was like, you should just have everyone sign it that's been on the podcast. And I was like, oh, my God, and then we can give it away to charity. And so this book has, and yesterday at the Star Wars panel, the last signature in the book is Harrison Ford.
Oh, shit.
And
it was a begrudging signature.
No, he was so nice
you
yesterday.
You want to sign this kid?
That was just really good.
What'd you do with my friend? Why is he the skin of your book? I fly planes.
Get out of my way, Bookie.
Ooh.
That was good.
He was
Get out
Sir
of my way, Ben Bookie. Kingsley's water
Give
is
to
now
your dad.
My dad's. Put it next to the tissue of Sir Paul McCartney.
He's got to slip that in his pocket.
So I went back to ask Sir Ben to sign the book, and so he signed the book.
Did he put it on Harrison's page and bid, like, the Ender's Game page?
No, he didn't do that. But and then also I had and Peter Mayhew signed it too, even though he wasn't on the podcast. We're like, you have to have Peter Mayhew sign the Chewbacca book.
Yeah,
so
you do.
I got shoved in a car with him to get out of Hall H. I was just there with Peter Mayhew and his wife and their friend. And
oh
she was
God.
Like, we love The Walking Dead. I'm like, it's Peter fucking Mayhew. Like, I was. And he was really funny. And she was like, you should ask him to sign your book. And he was like, Peter's not up here at the moment. And I said, well, I'll just set this book here if Peter shows up. And he's like, I'll ask him. And then he signed it.
Who was up there?
Everything's fine, Mrs. Torrance. I'm very honored to bring out our next guest because I've gotten to do a few things with him, and you know, you never know when the new guy takes over if he's gonna, you know, maybe he's like, this is just a job. But I can tell you, having spent quite a bit of time with this gentleman, he is lovely and every bit as much of a fan as you are. I am honored to welcome the 12th Doctor, Peter Capaldi.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. This has been a crazy couple of days for you, I would imagine.
Yeah, but very, very pleasant, very delightful. I arrived on Monday and really spent 2 days locked in a hotel room doing press. And people kept saying to me, are you nervous about what's going to happen out there? And the more they said that, the more nervous I would get. And I would look out the window and I would just gradually see someone arriving dressed as Yoda. I thought, I really want to go out there. I really want to go out and meet everyone and be part of all this. And they said, you can't. But then the night before our panel, I thought, I said to the security guys, put yourself in my shoes. You know, you're playing an iconic character of this nature, you know, Doctor Who. Go, let me go out there. So they let me go out and, like, one little kid came and said hello, and that was it. And I thought, oh, God, this is the way it's going to go. And then another one came, and then some guys came, and some gals came. And gradually, there was just a whole pile of people around me. And then we sort of kept wandering and wandered down to the line. I met everybody queuing up there. And that was fabulous. I've never seen anything like that before.
Is this your first Comic-Con?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
I mean, this is
imagine like being at your first Comic-Con, but now you're fucking Doctor Who.
Yeah. No, I can't literally imagine that.
Holy shit.
I'd like to.
Yes. But it's funny because I drove around today and I thought, I saw people enjoying themselves all over the place and they were dressed up as stormtroopers and stuff. I thought, boy, if I was 25, you know, if something like this had existed when I was 25, I would have so loved to have been here. But there's no better way to come than as Doctor Who.
No, weren't... I think... I'm positive I'm right about this. When you were around that age, weren't you in a band with Craig Ferguson?
I was, yeah. Craig was the drummer. He's a very, very good drummer.
Yeah.
And he used to make me laugh so much because he was funny, obviously. And but he used to show up. How long ago it was. We used to have pound notes, which, you know, £1 sterling. And Craig used to live, he won't like me telling this story, but he used to live in a satellite town of Glasgow. Glasgow was the kind of industrial centre, and there's a smaller town outside that he lived in. And he used to work in the post office.
What?
Yeah. And he used to come and be with us and be in a punk band and stuff like that and do gigs and then have to get back and be in the post office the next morning. And he always carried this little rolled-up pound, and that was his emergency pound. That was the emergency pound, which was to buy his late-night bus ticket back to the town he lived in.
Oh, my God. So what was the band called?
It had the worst name for a band ever. It was called the Dream Boys.
Peter Capaldi, I have to tell you that, like, you're set up to this. It's not going to be that bad of a name, I'm thinking. And then you lay down the Dream Boys, I'm like, fuck, he's right. That's a terrible name.
But it was a punk band, right?
It was, yeah, but we thought we were sort of slightly Kafka-esque and strange, and we were evoking nightmares, not really thinking we were evoking, like, the Chippendales, who were yet to come, who were yet to arrive.
Oh, my God. What were some of the Dream Boys songs?
Songs. Well, this is... We were so kind of steeped in sort of B-movie culture. I had a song called... The Outer Limits, which I remember had the line, which I was very proud of. We were not very musical or very successful, mainly because of my lyric writing. And I remember there was a line in that I was very proud of, which was, I didn't have the patience to live with those mutations.
It's a good line.
Good line.
That's a good line.
Yeah.
You must have done Ferguson's show when he was in the late show, right?
Yeah.
Did you guys play again together at that point? Did you even talk about playing together?
No, we didn't, but he said to me, do you mind, Peter? He said, when you come on, do you mind if I tell everyone that we dropped acid together? I suppose that would be all right, because that's what young people did at that time when we were very young in Glasgow. So he did that, and there was a rather eggy moment like this one, and we moved on.
But I think people assume, you know, just the idea of, like, we're going to go do acid with the Dream Boys. What?
Come on, that tempts you. That's a good night out.
What ultimately broke up the band?
Dream men came in.
Dream boys to men?
I think we were pretty terrible, really. Everybody else we knew became successful, and we didn't. And we thought, well, this is not really going to work for us. And we all got interested. We got very interested in comedy and acting and all that sort of stuff. So we sort of drifted off into those different areas.
Yeah. And then were your first jobs comedy jobs? Is that where you went first?
Yes. Yeah. My first real job, I was incredibly lucky, was I was in a movie called Local Hero, which had Burt Lancaster in it. Wow. So I suddenly found myself moving from being with Craig and his emergency pound to standing on a beach with Burt Lancaster.
And his emergency 20-pound note.
Yeah, yeah. Talking about Humphrey Bogart and Marilyn Monroe. And I thought, this is... how I got that job was, there was a guy who used to hang around the bands, and he was a film director called Bill Forsyth, who was very gifted. And he came and saw me in the band and afterwards said, how would you like to be in a movie? And I said, yeah, of course, I'd love to do that. Not realizing that it was like a proper movie. And I was thinking, oh, maybe he's going to cast me as, I don't know, like a sort of Scottish Thomas Jerome Newton and the Man Who Fell to Earth or something. But no, it was just as a geek. It was a geeky guy. But what an incredible break that was. And I thought, this is fate telling me this is what I should pursue. And it was a wonderful experience.
I mean, I watched the live stream of when they announced you as the Doctor. It was like a papal ceremony, almost.
it was pretty weird. I mean, the thing is, that's not really my comfort zone. You know, really, I'm an actor. That's what I'm used to. I'm used to acting with the camera and not being, you know, in show business. But, you know, I got this amazing job, which was being Doctor Who. And then the next thing they said to me was, we're going to announce it live on television and you have to be there.
We've just put white smoke into the stack. We have to announce it.
Exactly. So they did this whole number. They took me to the studio, like, with a blanket over my head. You know, they took me, they drove me to a car park to get me into another car, to take me to the studio where I was taken with the... They said there were people waiting outside. I never saw that. I don't know whether there were people there or not. Whether or not it was just that all made up. But it was a fantastic experience.
I love that the two things the whole of the UK will watch a live stream for is the announcement of the new Doctor Who or the announcement of Daniel Craig as James Bond. It's like, yeah. So the two things are like, oh, we got to find out who this
is. But then there's a whole Big Brother channel, too. So it's that, too. Yeah, it's true. Like they watch Big Brother and then they watch the... But you were so well known to come in to the Doctor and previously, you know, I mean, except for Eccleston, you know, people didn't really, yeah. People were somewhat familiar with Tennant and, you know, didn't really know Matt before.
Yeah. What's your point?
My point is...
I'm sorry. I just saw in his eyes, I've just been doing interviews all day today, and like so many times I've got sort of lost in time and space, you know, you set off, you know, trying to say something and you can't remember what the question is, and I just saw that look in your eyes there.
Do you know what it is? I take on a lot at Comic-Con, but I feel so present right now in this moment, and it's so surreal that all of a sudden you're here and they're here and we're just having a regular conversation, but there's a bunch of people there too. Have you been doing this all day?
Yeah. But you're the busiest man at Comic-Con.
I get so much stuff. No, you are.
It's great.
I had to, today at the Indigo Ballroom, I had to bail out Chris because he had to, we started the Nerdist panel, Chris hosted it, and I had to fill in for him because he had to run off to do Quentin Tarantino's panel.
I did.
Because you did how many panels this year?
11. I did 11 panels this year. But I can't not. I mean, you feel the energy here.
It's
fabulous. It's fabulous, and so, you know, I mean, Peter is, you know, one of the, it's like... OG Doctor Who fanboy, and so you understand that if someone when you were first watching the show, if they were like, hey, we're gonna let you be near this and a million other things that you are a huge fan of, you would go, well, fuck yeah, I gotta do that, I have to do
absolutely,
all that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You guys know about the letter that Peter wrote, right? Do you know the story? Do you have the letter, or do you just have a copy of the letter?
No, I have to say I wrote a lot of letters to a lot of people. I wrote to all the doctors. I wrote to the first four doctors and got replies from all of them.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Personal replies.
Personal replies, except for William Hartnell. Not because he was dead, but because... This is going to sound bad, but because he wasn't very well.
Sure.
But his wife replied to
me. Oh, that's and, somehow sweeter.
Yeah. And, I always think, you know, it always goes through my head what it was like to be, you know, I'm still a fan, you know. And so I the value of those autographs to me was kind of priceless. You know, they were just really important. I know that they weren't much other than, you know, a photo of a guy who was in a show that at that time wasn't, you know, the hot sort of giant thing that it is now. And that they took the time and that they replied to me, I thought was really great. And, of course, when I was 17, I threw them all away.
Oh, no.
Because I decided to become a punk then.
I'm a dream boy.
Yeah, I know. That's what happens. I know what it's like to be a fan. I'm still a fan.
Does it bum you out now that you can't watch it because you've read the script? You're like, oh, I know what happens. I'm not going to watch this episode.
I find it difficult to watch me in it.
Really?
Because I find the sort of the weight of it is quite immense, and I sort of can't sort of believe that I'm actually playing.
Is there any? Did you give yourself a chance to sort of try and detach from it and watch it and just sort of get to be a fan about it, regardless of the fact that you're sitting there driving the TARDIS?
Yeah, yeah. Eventually, I did, because also the gap between what we actually do, you know, I often see early cuts, but they are without CGI and they're without the music and they're without any of the
problems. I'm fighting a green thing again?
Yeah,
we got a CGI then.
I think it probably just looked like the original series.
Well, I often think that because sometimes when we get on the set, it's not quite as cosmic looking as you would like it to look.
Sure, yeah.
And I always think about the original guys and how they never wavered in their commitment to the program and in their commitment to the truth. You know, they might have the most unconvincing rubber monster and the most terrible sets that were shaken, but not for a second did they let you know that it wasn't real, that they weren't inhabiting every moment of that. And, you know, as an actor, you know, from any genre, I think that's a great, great lesson.
Yeah.
You know, and also you watch someone like Peter Cushing. Peter Cushing never gave a bad performance in his life. He was in some movies that were really cheap and not as good as he was, but he never, ever, ever did anything that wasn't with great grace and truthfulness and commitment. And I think that those are great lessons for actors. I think genre stuff is sort of harder to do than straighter stuff.
Yeah.
Because people think you just go and you just are a kid and you just play with the Daleks and you just play with the TARDIS. There is quite a lot of that goes on. But there comes a moment.
You just bring a bowl of cream up to a Dalek and go, look, it's a mixer. You know, they have the little mixer hands.
Yes, that's why everyone's
laughing. He's got a whisker. It's a whisker.
It's a whisker on the little Dalek. It has a little whisker, and you bring a bowl of cream up to it. Don't worry about it, Peter.
All right, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, how do you like it, Matt?
Yeah.
It's not great. You want to build a wall?
I think
go ahead.
We call it a sink plunger.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
That's right. Yeah. But I did the same thing. You don't know what a sink plunger is?
No, we have sink plungers here. We have drains.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's different. We call them plungers.
Lift. Oh.
No, because I did the same thing. I did a whole what I thought was a funny routine about Daleks and sink plungers and.
What I thought was a funny.
No, forgive me, I don't mean that, but I mean in front of an American audience who didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah, no. So what were the moments that you were talking about?
Sorry. We're lost in time and space again.
No, you can get us back.
Can we rewind?
You're the doctor.
Can we just go back?
Yes, God damn it, yes.
You're saying there are those moments. There are those moments. And when you get there, it doesn't feel, you know, but then you have those moments.
I think that you have to be as committed to these stories and to this character as, you know, anything, you know, that Ben was talking about. You know, you have to be that serious about it. I mean, it's a great, fun job, but you have to make it alive. And it's sort of my job to make sure that the Doctor remains a convincing being who exists, you know, while the camera is turning. And that can be challenging because the scripts are quite unique in the fact that they bounce from the tragic to the comic to the dramatic, you know, almost from moment to moment. So, I mean, that was one of the things that really surprised me about it because I thought, you know, because I'd, you know, in my head been playing Doctor Who for many years, that actually the real thing was a much tougher workout as an actor.
Yeah. I remember where I was going earlier with that point. And it was this.
Wibbly wobbly.
People, timey-wimey. People recognize you going into this role. So did you feel like there were expectations like, oh, we already know this guy, this is going to be great, or we already know this guy, this could be weird? Because, you know, because obviously you want to disappear into the role, but people know who you are.
No, I think it was one of those situations where you just, and even you know, I still do this. I don't sort of really look down, in the sense that I try not to be aware of the how many people are watching, or the scale of it, because I think that ultimately it's a very intimate thing. You know, acting is, you know, about making moments work, even if it's with, you know, rubber spiders or sets that shake or whatever. So I deliberately tried not to connect with the scale of the show as it is. I just thought, I've got to play this character that I love and that I felt a strong bond with. I mean, I think that was one of the useful things about being a fan, was that obviously I knew the history of the show and the canon and all that stuff, but that I had my own very deep bond with the character, which doesn't leave me and stays with me on the set and helps me, you know, in moments of trouble. And somehow, somewhere, you sort of find the Doctor. And he. The great thing about Doctor, the really striking thing about doing it is it's hard to talk about, but you know what is Doctor Who and what isn't Doctor Who. He tells you, the program tells you what works and what doesn't. And it's very clear when something is Doctor Who or isn't.
And did you, since you would want to do this your entire life, I would imagine this was in the back of your head your entire life, you'd want to do this. What was the most surprising thing to you about it? Because things are never always what you think they're going to be when you actually get in the position, right? Or did it fulfill everything?
Well, I wasn't sort of... I didn't wake up every day as an adult actor saying, oh, it's another miserable day of not being Doctor Who.
Matt Smith, you know, again!
You know, I didn't... You know, I spent...
You had a sad daily calendar you ripped off.
That's still not Doctor Who. And
that's why you...
I'm never going to go to the
ball. Dear Diary, July 31st, right. Still not Doctor Who.
That's right. In World War Z, you played Who Doctor. The clue was right there.
That's right. Yeah, but no, I've been around for like 30 years acting, you know, and not being Doctor Who. And I had been in Doctor Who, so I sort of
Fires of Pompeii, right?
Yeah, so yeah. I sort of thought that was my as close as I would get to it. And I loved that and enjoyed that. And David was fabulous, and it was wonderful to work with him.
Karen Gillan was in that, too.
That's right, yeah. I've forgotten the question. What was the question? Sorry. Not because it wasn't a great question.
No, I appreciate that.
It was just because I've like done 200 interviews today. I tell you, this is so relaxing. It's so nice to be here.
Just to have a conversation.
Yeah, and not to have to have fun.
Nice of you to come, Peter.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. You don't have to have fun.
That's right.
It's really refreshing to just get to break it down and have a terrible time.
But you know what I mean. There's a lot of pressure to
be on. Because people, you know,
well,
honestly...
short nuggets. You have to, like, really fucking pack it all into that little time you have with them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you guys probably watch Thick of It, too, right? People watch that show. One of the first things you say in that series is one of my favorite images, where I think it's something along the lines of, that's about as useful as a marzipan dildo. Where did that...
Nucci.
Well, that's written by the great Armando Iannucci, who does Veep.
Yeah.
I'm here. So that's one of his lines. But that was an amazing... show to do. I mean, that was an extraordinary... I mean, in a way, you know, I think that's probably what led me to Doctor Who, even though it's a completely different sort of thing.
Yeah.
It sort of transformed my career as an actor and certainly transformed the way that I acted, because the way that they do that show is they have a brilliant script you have to do a sort of word-perfect version of that script, but then once you've shot that, you do a totally improvised version of the same scene. And then they cut the best bits together. And they shoot it with zoom lenses, which means, you know, the camera could be way over there in the corner, but it might actually be, the image it might be getting, it might be a close-up this tight. So any ideas that I had about technique had to be thrown out of the window. Because, you know, you think you develop a little technique, you think, oh, I hear them, they're putting on an 85mm lens now or something, so I'll do an 85mm lens performance. It's all rubbish, you know. You just have to be truthful. And so the show really broke all of my notions of what technique was available to me and threw me into this strange maelstrom of swearing and drama and politics. And it kind of worked. And I think that sort of changed me completely as an actor and also completely changed casting directors' ideas of me because I think they had sort of forgotten about me a little bit. And suddenly I was doing this this evil political sort of spin doctor who I could only really play because life had roughed me up a little bit by that time. You know?
Right.
So I was able to apply that to the show.
Did you ever feel, seeing what you're doing now and seeing, you know, what's going on, were you impatient along the way? Like, oh, I just want something. I want more. I want this. Or were you just happy to be...
What do you mean, out of my career?
Yeah, just working pretty regularly. Or did you ever feel like... Was think of it, a type of a show. You're like, ah, finally, shit, yes. This is what I've been wanting.
Yeah, it sort of exploded. It was... You know, the most exciting thing about it was you'd be in a room with all of these hugely talented people. You know, with these writers and performers who were, you know, you daren't tell a gag because they would have calculated the punchline as soon as you said three gag, you know, they got the punchline.
Right.
So the level of wit just in the rehearsal room was terrifying. And then the actual process of shooting was one that, I mean, you know, we would just, the takes would be like 15 or 20 minutes long. You know, and Amanda would just keep making us work and work and work and work. And he never liked us to relax. He never liked us to rehearse. He would just put us into the situation. And that was a very radical way of working. But to be working with such talented people was the great joy of it. You know, I really believe in talent. I think that's what makes the difference. You know, a lot of people can take photographs, but there are only very few real photographers, you know, who have the eye to arrange the image in a certain way that people that resonates and people can make a connection with. And that's because they have a gift, which I've only cited photographers as a simple example. And it's the same with comedy or acting or painting or music or drawing, anything like that. It's having talented people around that makes the difference, and that's why it's so important that talent should be encouraged and people should draw and make music and try to do things. I mean, I never knew that I was going to be have any success as an actor. I mean, people like Craig and I, for instance, just did stuff. We were in a band because it was stuff to do. You know, it was a way of being creative and trying to make a world and create terrible songs. And you know, but it was a way of being creative. And I think that should be encouraged at all times.
Yeah, wonderful. I have to say, and I know this is probably going to sound patronizing because you're sitting right in front of me, in front of this, but it's not. I absolutely love you as the doctor. I really do. It's, and I say this every time, and it's the same sort of bittersweet thing that we all go through as Doctor Who fans, where you fall in love with one, and then they leave you, and it's hard, and you cry for a couple days, and then the new guy, you're a little like, you know, it's like if you lose a pet.
They make you watch it too, like they make you watch
they
him.
They make you they watch make you it. Watch yeah, you change. Have you witness
it's
it.
It's not like they're like Sean Connery, you're gonna turn into Roger Moore now.
But we're not gonna see
and
it.
And then they shoot him.
Yeah, there's no scene of Sean Connery going, I don't want to go. You know.
Connery. Connery would be, I can't fucking wait to leave.
Fuck this, fuck all you. But then you very quickly... snort. You very quickly start to bond. And I bonded with yours very fast. There's such a... The show took such a wonderfully dark turn, and I feel like your doctor is—he's ferocious and he's almost seems like he's trying to work out who the fuck he is and what's going on. It's like, yeah, he almost seems angry. It's like, I don't fuck, you know, like.
Yeah, I think he is. But yeah, that's, you know, that's really kind of you to say. I really appreciate that. I do. I don't know what you're laughing at. I do. That's, I'm being sincere. I am. Yeah, no, I think he is. The great thing about the doctor is, I think, when he regenerates, he doesn't know who he is, you know. And I absolutely love what Matt did. I loved the way that he was a young guy with this strange old wise head on his shoulders. And David had this fabulous sort of romantic quality about him, and really made the doctor an accessible person while still being an alien. And he was brilliant. And Chris Eccleston, I'm not going to go through them all, but yes. But I think it's really important to talk about those, what they did, because you know, I'm only here because of them, because they made the show successful. And Chris Eccleston, you know, came to it when nobody knew whether it was going to be successful. And Chris Eccleston is our... Yeah, I mean, he's our... he's the real thing, you know. He's a highly respected, brilliant actor who put himself out there and could have been in a huge turkey.
Of course.
But in fact, he brought Doctor Who back to life. So he deserves to be thanked for that. Again, I've forgotten the question.
It doesn't matter.
Lot,
everything you say
does it
is
matter?
Great. Yeah. I was lucky enough to, after our panel last couple days ago, it was a couple days ago, right? What year is it?
1955.
Oh.
1955.
But.
We're just referencing Back to the Future. Don't worry about it.
Is that a thing?
That's, yeah, Back to the Future.
All right. Okay.
It's another.
Another one of.
But I was lucky enough I got to have dinner with you guys, yeah, and so for me it's very hard to, because I want to be normal around you guys, but obviously I'm a fan, and so it's hard for me to contain that. And I was fortunate enough to, I got to talk to Stephen Moffat for like an hour and a half about Doctor Who, and you think, oh, he's not going to want to talk about this. He talks about this all the time, and he kept letting the conversation go, and sort of connected to what you said about the doctors that came before you, bless you, or science, whatever your belief system might be.
I had dinner with Moffat 2 years ago, and all we talked about was World War II.
Oh, you're talking about World War II? We talked about The Prisoner, and we talked about Doctor Who. And I told him, I said, you know, I even loved seeing McGann, like, for a second in that little short, the War Doctor. And Stephen said, can I tell you, I absolutely loved that. And I thought he did such a wonderful job.
Yeah, I tried to get Paul's belt. He wears a little snake belt, which is, it won't probably mean anything to you guys, but to guys of Paul's the same age as me. And when we were little kids, these are the kind of belts we wore to school. And I thought it was very touching that that's what he had in his Doctor Who costume. And I tried to get, I did buy one to put in my Doctor Who costume to wear under my jumper, but you never see it. And then the costume department lost it.
No!
Because I wanted to do a little thing that was a nod to him.
Well, they can just go find another one. For season 9,
for
or
season
series 9,
nine, yeah,
as you would say.
We have a very tight budget.
Oh, it opened up. They don't have to pay Clarkson anymore. You're fine.
Yeah.
Get a lot of extra money.
So just, you know, my apologies, because I know you've answered this a million times today, and you've been so gracious to be here. I know we have to let you go in a second, and we have to let you guys go because we have a second show. What do you think people can look forward to in season 9?
I think it's a big, adventurous season. I think Clara and the Doctor have sort of got into a groove where they realize just how lucky they are to be together and to have the whole of time and space available to them. So they go charging out there, throwing themselves in danger's way and being quite reckless. It's got a sort of cinematic sweep to it. Visually, it looks brilliant. And I think, you know, 2,500 years of age I think the doctor has realized that life is short. He should enjoy himself. But of course, being as it's Doctor Who, it's not that simple. And there's something coming behind him that is going to be very difficult for him to deal with.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for being so gracious.
We've done
a few of these, and you're always so kind.
Thank you.
Congratulations, and honestly, all the best. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Capaldi! Peter Capaldi. And
ooh.
Oh, and Ashley, would you please ask Peter Capaldi to sign the Chewbacca book? Okay, great. Thank you very much. Just find a page that has an open space and scribble inside.
Guys.
Is this why you...
Oh, man. Jonah's going to talk to B.D. Wong and merge them.
Yeah.
It's a Jurassic Park.
Da-na-na-na-na-na. Wait. I got to get that in slow-mo. Yeah. Ready?
Won't be flattering.
All right. Here we go.
Jonah, ready? You're going to regret having this in the world.
Yeah. Ready? Great. Thank you. I'm glad we did that. I'm very glad. So, as I said, there is a second show, but I feel like this wouldn't be... by the way, how was the Meltdown show?
It was a lot of fun. We had a good time.
I heard Steve Young drop by.
Yeah, I did a sketch with Steve Young. It was a good time. It was really fun. Thomas Middleditch came and did it. It was a good way to let people know that the Meltdown is a show on Comedy Central, 12:30 a.m. on Tuesday nights, technically Wednesday morning.
Nice.
Slid it in.
That's awesome.
Great. Yeah. I haven't seen you this entire weekend. I have not. This is the first time. You walking on stage the first time.
I know. Well, I went to the Nerdist party for a couple hours last night.
Heard you were there. Did a loop. I did several because I just wanted.
I didn't want to be. I wanted to be as present as possible because it was a very big year for us. We announced a lot of things. We're distributing a movie called The Hive.
Great movie.
Which is really cool. Which you saw and you're friends with the guys and we also. You know, it looks like the bowling show, All Star Bowling, is going to land at another network, but I can't say which one yet.
Puny? Talk about Puny.
Puny. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Puny, but Puny is an animation house that's run by our friend Shadi, who was on the podcast a couple years ago. Shadi went through gender reassignment, and it was a wonderful episode, and we've been friends for ages, And Puny is a phenomenal animation company. Mike Furman and I did a pilot with them for IFC several years back, and
done a lot of Yo Gabba Gabba stuff.
Yo Gabba Gabba, yeah. And then the opening to Super, James Gunn Super, they did, and they do a lot of different stuff. And so this opportunity came along, and so I bought half of Puny. So
so the Nerdist is essentially the Borg.
Well, Puny isn't Nerdist. It's me.
It's Chris Hardwick. It's not a subsidiary.
I just wanted to invest in Shadi and invest in Puny, and so I just bought half the company personally. I'm not going to be going back and forth to Minneapolis.
Hey, buddy, it's going to be a little less gas in the Jaguar, right? You got to tighten the belt a little bit.
We have to put that to bed, Matt. We have to put that to bed.
If you get a different car, though, it'd be more fun.
Stop it. All right. So I'm very excited about that because I've been animation was a very big deal to me my entire life.
You went to school for it for a little bit.
I did. You couldn't major in animation at UCLA. You could take the classes, but you had to be a film major to actually major in animation. So, I tried to be a layout artist for Ren and Stimpy in the early 90s, and I was not that great of an artist. I thought I was good, and then I saw what real artists were like, and I'm like, oh, fuck, yeah, I'm not that. I'll just tell dick jokes. And so
And so animation is very important. So, you know,
we're going to make
hopefully cartoons and hopefully some maybe mobile gaming, or I don't know, but I'm just excited and I love Shaddy, and so I'm just glad to be able to be involved in that. But I feel like this would not be a live Nerdist podcast at San Diego Comic-Con if we didn't do a few
Before you got here.
They'll all be for you. We took our questions. We got them out of the way.
But the people listening at home don't. If they already heard.
Good point.
No, I mean, they don't want to hear Quements again.
No,
probably.
They do.
No, we're going to cut our
Here's
part
the deal.
Out.
They're cut our
we're
part
not
out.
Cutting out your
Wasn't
part.
Wasn't good.
Oh. But now we've referred to it, so I feel like we're obligated to leave it in.
Let it be shrouded in mystery.
Yeah.
Did they do a good
people
job before I got here?
People
Matt got a lap dance.
Interesting. Not the whole crowd.
No, people at home do not need to hear about Boston time traveling Batman.
You know what?
Amazing.
The time traveling part was a bit of a jump.
You know what though? But we have about 10 minutes before we have to clear out the theater for the next
get
show.
Get out there
so.
And get a real question.
It's a question. I see this young man has a question.
Lights on.
Nope. Okay, I'm kidding.
Illuminate.
Yes. You right here.
Turn the house lights up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, hello. Were you just looking for your seat, or were you? Oh, okay. Great. Hello.
Given one of them a wonderful lap dance earlier wearing my 10th Doctor dress.
That is really... I mean, I have a semi.
Now you're being real jealous.
Wait for the punchline.
That guy gave Matt a lap
10th
dance. 10th
Doctor dress.
I'm sorry I said that as I'm squatting over you, ma'am. I just realized where I was. And I'm just facing this way, and no wonder you're clutching your purse like this. I apologize profusely. Yes, sir.
So the punchline is, I'm a perfect 10.
Yes! Oh, genius! I can't believe I missed that.
I like that.
Thank you, sir. What is your name?
More of a comment or a quement. I just want to say thank you for getting me through. You know, there was a tough time last year, and it really meant a lot to me, this and Doctor Who and the Pro U podcast. I wanted to give you each individualized gift, but there are so many of you, so I got you these. If you can give.
Well, there's just three of us, really.
Well, he also said the Pro U, which is
Kobe and Katie and Kyle and everyone. And the rest. No. Oh, yes. You are pretty fucking awesome. That is all. Oh, that's awesome. They're just little messages that say, hey, you're pretty fucking awesome. And I feel like we can give these out to people as well. Oh, thank you.
Anyone you deem equally as awesome as yourself.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to meet you. I'm going to give you one to take away. All right. So I like how that works. Yes, sir.
Chris, put Sophie. My name is Graham. I come from the same area as Peter Capaldi.
Kentucky? I'm kidding.
Swish.
It's little... Listen, thank you very much for the life advice you're putting in your podcasts. Ben Kingsley talked about the curse of immortality. At 19, I died in that satellite town Peter Capaldi spoke of, Cumbernauld.
First of all, you look amazing.
Really? Yeah. It was a bad day. It was bad things happened. You see the bumps on my forehead?
Not really,
yeah,
but
you
I see
a little
yeah.
bit of them. That's yeah. fractured skull.
Jesus.
It was actually a factory Craig Ferguson worked in at one point as well. But
so he's responsible?
Sort of, yeah. Yeah. But the whole Doctor Who thing as well, when you've gone through something I have, a survivor, you see people pass. Like the doctor sees companions passing. And it becomes very difficult to deal with in the real life. But watching people like Peter Capaldi dealing with that as a doctor, Matt Smith, Ben Kingsley, whoever, it helps. And your life advice things help. Morgan Freeman, people like that, anyone you talk to with ideas about how to get through a better day. And I had such a great speech planned out, but it comes up.
I think you're doing great. Are you
it's
kidding?
Real good, man.
By the way,
fucking nailed it.
By the way, I just want to tell you just how charming you are. If you had an American accent, people would be like, move along. But because You're so charming to listen to and so sincere and so wonderful.
Thank you.
And so I mean, we appreciate that. Because, I mean, obviously it's fun for us to come and fuck around and, like, dick around and, oh, we're making silly wiener jokes and stuff. But, you know, these are conversations. We're just trying to work shit out, too. So they are as meaningful to us, hopefully, as they are to you. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Chris. And keep up the great work. Matt, Joanna, great guys.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. A pleasure. Thank you for living. Thank you for living. Enjoy your burrito as well.
It's really hard to follow.
Yeah, what are you going to do now?
Actually, I do have something I thought of.
Dude, I took a shit in the shape of the TARDIS. What? And it made the same noise.
Genius. Woo! I can't do it.
Perfect. You get points for that joke.
So this is actually one that I thought about, and it's an open question for all of you guys. Because of Selfless, if you were to transfer your consciousness into not only one of Ben Kingsley's characters, but the entire world that it's in,
Fillmore.
What would it be?
Beautiful callback to something Chris didn't see.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm so in the dark.
Just giant smile on his face, but like dead in the eyes. He's like, uh-huh. Yeah.
See, now we're going to have to leave your parts in because that callback's not going to make any sense otherwise.
Here's how I think we should do it. Those listening right now, if you stay tuned, you'll hear the first part of the show. Because that way we don't have to like bother the people who don't give a shit about us.
I think you're not giving yourself enough credit.
I think
you're
not giving yourself enough credit. Like a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
What is this?
So it's a little bit of a shameless plug. You guys put our game on your websites, Ghostbusters game, and we just got some new figs, and I wanted to bring them for you so you can have them.
Oh my God, it's an Ecto, and it's a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Stay Puft and cool stuff. And two, Jonah, you played tabletop, you played Epic Spell Wars, and you were Faye Ticklebottom the Enchanter.
Faye Ticklebottom, that's right.
The whole time I'm just hearing it in my voice. would you mind doing the voice again?
I'm trying to remember what I did. My voice is so thrashed. It's like, oh, it's Faye Ticklebottom. I'm so sorry. That's just Ed Grimley, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, yeah, I was in the moment, and now I'm not, and I'm sorry. Okay, you know what? Rewatch the episode. I bet it's great.
Yeah. Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you so much for bringing these. I really appreciate it. Hello, what's your name?
Hi, Melanie.
Hey, Melanie, what's your question?
I really love The Nerdist Way, the book. And I just wanted to say for all of you guys, for no one who's read the book, FYI, pick it up. It's awesome.
Fucking do it.
Yeah. So for those who haven't read it, if each of you had a tip to give to everyone for following their dreams and finding their success, what would you tell them really quick?
You know, the simplest answer that I feel like we always keep coming back to on this show is just doing it. Like, there's no magic. Like, no one comes out with a, you know, shoots a gun in there and goes, boom, go! Like, you just have to make the decision. You have to make the decision. I heard someone say once that, you know, I mean, and I took Latin, so I actually know this to be true, that etymologically deciding, you're cutting off other possibilities. So you just have to cut off the other possibilities and just focus on the one that you want to do. And then you just keep doing it until it fucking works. And if it doesn't work right away, you learn what went wrong and you figure it out, and then sooner or later, it's not like there's a magical point where you're like, I just made it across the, I mean, like me being here and doing all these panels, it's not like I went, I think I'm qualified to do the Star Wars panel. Like, I was just there and all of a sudden it fucking happened, and it was as weird to me as it was to anyone that I was up there, and it just was the sum total of a lot of decisions that I made that were hopefully in the direction of things that I wanted. So I think that's the best advice that I can give, if that's helpful.
Ditto.
It is. And right now, I really want to take a selfie. So can
okay. We can't start a whole line, but you're so sweet that I... Yeah. All right, good. Thank you. And we'll just get through these last few people, and then that'll be... Hello.
Name's Steven. Anybody else was here last night for the show?
I was.
Yeah. Well, you told this incredible story about how you're scared of heights.
Yes.
I am too, so I sympathize with you. About how you got up this hill and with your girlfriend, and you were afraid about letting her know.
Yeah.
Boy, yeah. And you told this immaculate story how you got up there and you made it to the top. But you left one thing out.
What?
How the hell did you get back down?
I do have an answer for you.
Helicopter.
Yep, yep. We, where we were driving
once you drove up this mountain, we were at a different elevation, so we didn't have to go back down. You know, back down's... No, it's pretty fucking scary, actually, yeah. I'm still terrified that someday she's Lydia's going to go, let's just drive up the one, which to me... The one is a treacherous stretch of road.
It's awful.
When you're getting, like, right before, when you were in between, like, San Luis Obispo
and San Francisco.
And Big Sur. And it's
just like you're a fucking mountain goat.
Yeah, you really are. And you hear these stories where they're like, oh, yeah, a chunk of the road just broke off.
Yeah.
And it's fucking terrifying. Yeah, so I didn't actually have to get back down. So.
Is that worth a selfie?
Okay, sure. Yeah, I'll do that.
There are just signs warning you on the one that part of the road may fall from beneath you.
May fall. That's all right. What is your name?
Leslie.
What's your question?
My best friends and I have something for Matt Myra.
You do? What is it?
It is a poster, and it's called Line by Line, and the artist did 007, but it's made out of the whole entire script from Skyfall.
What? Oh,
that's really cool.
This is amazing. Look at that.
Oh, shit.
That is fucking awesome. This is the script of Skyfall, and it's in the and there's a little bit of negative space where it's Daniel Craig right there. That's fucking amazing.
That's crazy. Where's my gift? Oh, man, I can't wait. I bet it's going to be so good, guys.
Can I get this one? Oh, this is amazing. Interior, Turkey, Bond, Ronson's down.
We were trying to find something for you. We didn't know what to get you. But
you figured it out.
I did. Yeah, but I was wondering if you think you ask such great questions because you've been in therapy for so long.
I don't know if I ask great questions. I just ask curious questions. And I have been in therapy for a long time, and I feel like therapy's good. Even if you don't feel, and it's nothing to be ashamed of, even if you don't feel like, oh, there's nothing wrong with me, it's so good to have someone that you can talk to once a week without fear of judgment, where you can just say, you need to get that out. It's like it's like physical exercise. You need to do that. You need to clear out the brain pipes, and that's a great way to do it. So it's very important.
Yeah. Thank you for Holly.
Thank you very much for being there. I really appreciate it.
This is amazing, by the way. I'm still reading it.
It's the whole thing. Yeah, that's Matt's whole night right there.
So I need to ask you a favor.
Please.
So I'm doing a scavenger hunt.
Yes.
And I need you to say these lines, if you can. And I need to get you on video.
Okay. I don't know what I'm about to read. I could be committing something horrible to video right now. And furthermore, fuck all the babies in the world. No, what?
I knew it.
Okay, you ready? Did you want flash in the video? I am Chris Hardwick, and I just won Karma 10,000 points in the Wikiest Scavenger Hunt! Can you turn it back on? Oh, you think you did it. I hope that worked out. I see a little video thing there. Yeah, I did it.
Chris, one more time with feeling.
Oh.
That's Hello. The best episode of Buffy ever. What's
yeah,
feeling.
It's a good reference. Oh, you got it. Good. I was going to do a disclaimer and say, this does not actually count as 10,000 karma points. Here you go. Congratulations. I hope you win a thing. What are you going to win in the scavenger hunt?
I think it's, I don't know.
Okay, good. All right. I think maybe just time for one more question. I'm so sorry.
I just want to say a quick thank you because listening to you and reading the book and everything, my friend and I, we started a podcast. We've been going 2.5 years and we're closing in on 100 episodes.
Nice. The centennial post-apocalypse. Nice. Oh, you are very welcome. All right. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Chase and I have a question for you.
I may have an answer.
Will you please be my stepdad?
How does your mom feel about that?
I'm sure she's on board with it.
I didn't say I was going to fuck everyone's moms.
We did earlier.
Okay, I kind of did a little bit.
Chris, we're getting the light from the venue back here, so...
All right.
You better fuck his mom.
Yes. Yes, thank you so much. Tell mom I'll be home later. Stay off drugs, eat your peas. Keep your hands off your pecker all day long, son. You only get so many... What? Oh, yeah, you guys. Good to see you guys again. Thank you so much for coming. I just want to, again...
I don't want to sound too schmaltzy. I don't want to sound... But the experience of being at Comic-Con every year, it is a lot of work, but it's also very meaningful to me because this is a safe zone for all of us. And being able to be part of the celebration and part of the fandom and getting to present things to you means the world to me. So I'm sorry I was scattered this week and late to some things, but I cannot thank you enough for coming out to the Nerdist Podcast live tonight with Peter Capaldi, Sir Ben Kingsley, Jonah Ray,
Chris Matt Hardwick, Myra. Everybody.
Enjoy your burrito!
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.